We've now completed our second week of our Immerse reading in Kingdoms, which is Joshua through 1 and 2 Kings in the Old Testament. And this past week, we read together Judges and Ruth. And so I'm going to be focusing in on Ruth a bit today, but I'm also going to back up and pick up a little of the story of Judges, just a little. I invite you to turn with me to page 83, which is the beginning of Ruth, as I read what is the first chapter in Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone, without her two sons or her husband. Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord has blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland. With her two daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah. But on the way, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back to your mother's homes, and may the Lord reward you for your kindness to your husbands and to me. May the Lord bless you with the security of another marriage." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. "No," they said, "we want to go with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters, return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me." And again they wept together, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. But Ruth clung tightly to Naomi. "Look," Naomi said to her, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same." But Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us." When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. So the two of them continued on their journey. When they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival. "Is it really Naomi?" the women asked. "Don't call me Naomi," she responded. "Instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me home empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has caused me to suffer and the Almighty has sent such tragedy upon me?" So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by her daughter-in-law Ruth, the young Moabite woman. They arrived in Bethlehem in late spring at the beginning of the barley harvest. I get cold, so I turn up the thermostat. A little while later, my wife Beth turns it down. I get chilled again and turn it back up. Then Beth opens a window. Then I make remarks about wasting money warming up the outdoors. Beth tells me to put on a sweater. I say I don't like wearing sweaters. Round and round we go, in a regular little cycle that happens in our house throughout the winter. Most relationships have these cycles. As a pastor, I've heard couples tell me about much worse patterns of interaction that go around in circles. He fails to put clothes away, and she complains. Then he points out how she always forgets to lock the car. And then she brings up some more serious infraction from years ago, like when he flirted with another woman. And then he tells her she's getting fat. Then she begins to cry and shout something that starts, "You never," and he gets angry and yells back words that begin with, "You always." And they're off, round and round, louder and louder, more and more painful, that same cycle of hurt and conflict happening over and over in that home. Our reading from Kingdoms this past week started with a vicious cycle of hurt and conflict among God's people, Israel. It's described right there on pages 45 and 46 in Judges. The people would sin, worship other gods, and so God would allow them to be defeated and enslaved by their enemies, those Canaanites who were still left in the land around them. And then the people would be sorry and cry out to God in supplication. And then he would listen and send them a judge, someone to lead them in successful fights against their enemies, and so they had received salvation, be saved, and have peace for a while. And there it is again. The Israelites sin against the Lord. The Israelites are afflicted by their enemies. The Israelites cry out to the Lord for deliverance, and the Lord raises up judges who deliver the Israelites from their enemies. But then they'd have peace for a while, and then that judge would die, and they would forget and start sinning and worshiping other gods again, and the cycle would start all over. What looks like a cycle is often actually a downward spiral. Marriages locked in ugly cycles of conflict can sink down until there's almost no way, it seems, to climb out. The same thing happened to Israel. Just skim through looking at the lengths of those times of peace which came after a judge saved Israel. Starts out with Othniel bringing 40 years of peace, and then 80 years of peace after Ehud, then 40 after Deborah, and then 40 while Gideon was still alive. But then on page 61, we read that Tola judged Israel for 23 years, and then Jer led them for 22 years. And it keeps going down, and the judges keep getting worse. On page 65, we read that Jephthah has just 6 years. Then Ibsen lasted 7 years, and Elon made it to 10, while I've got a name wrong here. Somebody else only got to 8. The last great judge that's talked about, Samson, is definitely a piece of work, as I say, the Sylvester Stallone of the judges. And despite his might, he only lasted 20 years, nowhere near those first. And then the last part of Judges has no heroes at all, just stories of idolatry and sin and civil war within Israel itself. And by the end, they've pretty much hit bottom. But for Israel during the time of the Judges and for our own relationships, what's needed is something to break the cycle. Something needs to change direction, reverse the course, transform hearts and minds so that peace can return to human lives once again. The last chapters of Judges tell us that what the answer is not going to be. We read it in the middle of page 72, Judges 17:6. In those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. That translation's a little deceptive. It might sound as though people together determined what was right, but the original is in the singular. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. In other words, each individual determined his own morality, decided her own course of action. There was no king to bring them together under the rule of God's law or to act for a common good. The first part of that slogan about there being no king is repeated at the beginning of the next two chapters, at the bottom of page 72 and on page 74. And the whole thing, including the part about everyone doing individually whatever he or she felt was right, is the very last sentence in the book on page 80. Doing what each sees fit. Israel, at that point, is not just fighting external enemies, but fighting internally at war with each other. The strange thing is that what the author of Judges clearly takes to be a problem, this individual self-determination of every person for his or herself, is taken as the norm or even the best order of things by people in our own time. Christian philosopher Stephen Davis recently wrote an article entitled, "Nobody Has the Right to Tell Me What to Believe or Do." And he's reflecting on the fact, and he writes that over the years as a college professor, has often heard students express feelings along the lines that anybody who tries to tell me what to do is interfering with my personal rights. It's not just students. It seems to be very much the spirit of our time as much as of the time of the judges. And even Christians get caught up in this. No one can tell me whether or not to have an abortion. No one can tell me I can't buy any sort of gun I want to own. No one can tell me I can't kill myself. No one can tell me whom I can have sex with. No one can tell me I can't smoke marijuana if I feel like it. Even if we don't like some behaviors around us as Christians, we may still support that personal right of each individual to decide for himself or herself. Yet seeking individual rights to guide your own life solves nothing. It did not solve it for Israel, it does not solve it for fighting couples, and it has not solved anything for our nation. Respect for human rights is vital, but when it dissolves into each person doing whatever is right in his or her own eyes, the cycles of conflict continue to spiral downward. Something very different from individual autonomy was needed for Israel, and it's needed for us today, too. Fortunately, the first sign of that something different appears in the very next book we read this past week, the short, sweet, beautiful story of a foreign woman named Ruth. On page 83, at the very beginning of Ruth's story, we learn that it took place in the days when the judges ruled Israel. And what immediately follows is what you might expect from what we just finished in Judges, the bad news that a severe famine came upon the land. And there's more sadness to follow. An Israelite woman named Naomi went to live as a refugee with her husband and two sons in the land of Moab, only to have both her husband and her sons die there and leave her almost alone with just her two foreign to her Moabite daughters-in-law. And if this were still the book of Judges itself, we could expect some sordid tale of oppression or abuse to follow. But this is where the Judges cycle begins to change, to alter course, and maybe even be turned back. Naomi starts home for Israel. Orpah and Ruth, her daughters-in-law, begin to go with her, and we read on page 83 how Naomi dissuades them. There's nothing for them where she's going, she says. She's not going to give birth to any more sons for them to marry. They should go home to Moab, and she should go back to her little town of Bethlehem in Judah. Naomi's concern for her daughters-in-law is where the pattern of Judges first starts to turn around. Those Moabite women were ready to go with her. They would have been a huge help to the older woman who should not be traveling alone on a long journey in foreign territory. But Naomi did not think about her own welfare. She put the younger women's interests ahead of her own and tried to send them home. It worked with one. After Naomi's second plea, Orpah did the sensible thing and turned back. But Ruth stuck with her and said these words, which may be familiar to you. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. In the church, we often hear those words of Ruth at a wedding. We think of them as the kind of commitment brides and bridegrooms make to each other, like Allison and Johnny will this afternoon. And so they should. The Bible teaches that men and women are to leave behind other ties and cling to each other in faithfulness and love, remaining with each other for the rest of their lives on earth. However, we see here that Ruth's words were first spoken, an expression of a commitment that's only partially based on marriage. Ruth's husband was gone, her family tie to Naomi was broken, and Naomi had released her. Yet she chose to embrace not only Naomi, but all she represented. Ruth committed herself to her mother-in-law's people and to her God. The cycle of judges is starting to unravel here. Ruth does not seek her own individual self-interest. She doesn't do just what's right in her own eyes and what's best for her. She puts Naomi's will ahead of her own will. She lets Naomi decide where she will go, and even lets Naomi decide what she will believe. This humble foreign woman becomes the catalyst by which God will heal his people and bring them back together. When Ruth came to Bethlehem, that commitment to Naomi's God changed her into something other than a foreigner. If you read it last week, you know how the story turns out. When they arrive, everyone recognizes Naomi in amazement. She had been gone 10 years. The two set up a household, and Ruth, the foreign woman, a refugee, now herself in Israel, goes out to provide for Naomi in the only way possible, as a beggar. With other poor people, she gleans barley behind the men who are harvesting. And there, she's noticed by the Israelite man who owns that field, Boaz. In Boaz, we find the third character in the story who refuses to act like the Israelites in Judges did. Boaz was totally unlike that Levite on pages 74 to 76 in Judges who treated his concubine, another woman from Bethlehem, like a piece of property and threw her out the door to appease an angry mob of rapists. Instead, Boaz treated this woman Ruth, this foreign woman, with the utmost respect and honor. The rest of the story is a beautiful tale of love and grace. Boaz is smitten with Ruth and tells his men to leave extra barley on the ground for her and to protect her. And so for the rest of the season, she goes only to his field. Finally, through Naomi's advice and some ancient symbolism and custom that if the truth be told by all the scholars, no one really quite understands now, Ruth announces her own affection for Boaz by lying down at his feet one night on the threshing floor. What's exactly going on there with Ruth and Boaz that night on page 86 is confusing, but one thing is clear. Unlike Samson and that Levite and many other men in the time of the judges and in our own time, Boaz is a man who does not take physical advantage of women. It was dark. No one else knew that Ruth was near him. When he woke up and found her there, he could easily have had sex with her, whether she wanted it or not. Instead, Boaz acted as what Naomi first called him on page 85, a redeemer. As we learn in what unfolds, Boaz's role as a redeemer has something to do with kinship and keeping land in the family. It's part of God's law given in Leviticus 25. Calling on the Israelites to come to the aid of poor relatives so that land is not lost. Instead, it's to be redeemed. And here, it's also connected in some way with the responsibility to care for widows in one's own family, even to the point of marriage and siring children in the name of a dead sibling or relative. We've already seen that Boaz is clearly attracted to Ruth and thus not at all adverse to marrying her, but he puts his own interest to one side and deals with her honorably and according to the law. He wants to marry her, but there's a legal difficulty because of a nearer relative's claim on her dead husband's land. It's a romance story, after all, so there's always got to be some obstacle between the lovers. But it's all worked out on page 87. The other relative who might have redeemed the land and also had to marry Ruth releases his claim. And so Boaz redeemed the land and redeemed the life of that Moabite refugee. Ruth, the foreigner, becomes Ruth, the wife of Boaz. The elders pronounce on her an ancient Hebrew blessing in chapter 4, saying to Boaz, "May the Lord make this woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, from whom all the nations of Israel descended." And it's a sign of her acceptance, not just into Boaz's home, but into the nation itself. They welcome her as one of their own, as a citizen. Jewish people still use a blessing like that for their daughters on the evening of the Sabbath. May God make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Ruth's story then continues. As you might expect, she became a wife and then a mother. Ruth and Boaz had a little boy. They gave him a name that sounds strange to us, Obed. When they were young, my daughters used to laugh when they heard the story of little Obed. They just thought that name was so funny. But there's more to the story than just a sweet baby and a happy ending. Obed was a very important little boy in God's plan. The book of Ruth ends with a bit of genealogy on page 88. And at the end of it, we read these last three lines. Boaz was the father of Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David. Obed became the grandfather of a king, the second and greatest king of Israel. It was King David who finally and wonderfully broke that cycle of misery handed down from the time of the judges. David and his son Solomon after him gave Israel 80 more years of peace. David redeemed Israel out of its misery because Boaz redeemed a foreign woman and a little plot of ground. We'll read about David in weeks to come, how Israel had a bad king first and then was given David, a man after God's own heart. Ruth's part in David's story is amazing when you look at what it says in Deuteronomy 23:3. "No Ammonite or Moabite, or any of their descendants shall enter the assembly of the Lord." And that's because the Moabites refused passage and food and water to Israel as they came to Canaan. But in the mercy and the grace of God, even that conflict and exclusion changes, and a Moabite became the ancestor of the kings of Israel. This beautiful triptych by Thomas Matthews Rook. Terry talked to us Saturday evening about the importance of art for Christians, and so here's a little art. And you can see the story of Ruth unfold as she first clings to Naomi, and then she is blessed by Boaz as he sees her there and takes care of her. And then she stands here with Naomi as the old woman cradles little baby Obed in her arms. For some reason, the sequence in this is right to left. Now, that's the way Hebrew reads, but I think maybe it's almost as if the painter was expressing the fact that Ruth had reversed the order of things, had undone that cycle of sin and despair that started in the time of the judges. Ruth the foreigner became Ruth the wife because of her commitment to God. Common faith overcame the division of race and nationality. Because she chose to trust in the Lord of Israel, she was no longer a foreigner in that land. It's a story of God's redemption, even of those who seem most distant from Him and from His people. Common faith in the one true God is still the only real redemption of unity in our world. Only faith in God can transform foreigners into friends and undo the hurtful cycles of our relationships. You know, belonging to a political party is not going to unify people. Common citizenship or race or even marriage by itself can't bring lasting peace. The only thing which brings different people together in enduring unity is God's redeeming love. And so, as they used to say in television ads, there's more. 1,000 years later, descended from David, descended from Jesse, descended from Obed, and yes, descended from faithful Ruth, the refugee who came as a foreigner from Moab, there was another baby born in Bethlehem. His mother, who was also a refugee for a while, named him Jesus. He is the Redeemer of us all. He is the one who came to purchase us for God with his blood and with his love. He is the Redeemer who can completely and totally break and undo all the sinful cycles of our lives and bring us peace with each other and with God. You may feel caught in an ugly cycle with someone. You may feel foreign or even be foreign to others around you. Even if you do not know it, you are waiting for your Redeemer, the one who wants to break the cycle and bring you in or restore you to the family of God. Jesus is the one. Jesus is the Redeemer. He's your good King who has come to change it, change everything, to turn things around, to turn you around. There are no foreigners in his kingdom. And the only thing which comes round and round again are his love and grace. Amen.